1 Kings chapter 7. We're actually going to quickly kind of review where we left off last time. We're right in the middle of the reign, the life and reign of King Solomon, and we're looking primarily at the first 20 years of his reign. Recall that you can really subdivide Solomon's reign into three big chunks, or at least the narrative, the way it's recorded in 1 Kings, you can subdivide into three big chunks. Each chunk is, it contains a word from the Lord, where God either directly appears to Solomon in a dream, or indirectly through the sending of a prophet. A prophetic word is, for instance, in chapter 11. But we begin with noticing Solomon's request and demonstration of wisdom from God. That's 1 Kings chapters 3 and 4. And now we're in the middle section of the life and reign of Solomon, which is really 1 Kings chapters 5 through 10, which wherein Solomon builds a mighty kingdom. And we're looking, last time, if you were with us, we took the time to read chapters 6 and 7 in their entirety in order to read, well, almost their entirety. There's a section that we're going to read this morning. But it's really covering Solomon's building accomplishments, what he is able to build. Primarily, most importantly, is the temple. And so that was our focus last time, was in fulfillment of the promises of God, the prophecies from Moses, etc. We see Solomon building the temple, which is the permanent version of the wilderness tabernacle. It's a hugely important moment in redemptive history, and it's of course a building that is to match the splendor of the building is to match the glory and importance and significance of the moment. And so we'll recap that briefly, but then also this morning we're going to look at his other building accomplishments, which are summarized. They're not given near as much ink, but they're summarized briefly at the beginning of chapter 7. And so if you're with us last time, we really took the time to read it verse by verse and go through chapters 6 and 7 and read the description of Solomon's temple, the building of Solomon's temple. Then we use this illustration to kind of march through the different pieces that were built and described in these chapters and the glory and the splendor of them. I don't know if I shared this stat with you last time, but by modern estimates, the splendor and the glory of Solomon's temple is obvious as we read the account. But by modern standards, the estimate is that it would have cost about $17 billion. In modern money. And so it was a very elaborate temple, a lot of gold. In fact, the term gold appears 6 times in 3 verses and then 11 times total in the chapter as we read the description of Solomon's temple being built. Obviously, the word gold, as one scholar put it, is the magic word in the description. Gold, 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 gold. And it just keeps rehearsing that and repeating that. And of course, we got a feel for that as we read those verses last time. But the splendor and the beauty of Solomon's temple is, it functions pragmatically as well as theologically. Let me just recap that quick before we kind of move on to Solomon's other building projects. But I mentioned this briefly last time at the end of last hour, but many ancient temples, in fact, functioned as a sort of national treasury. It was kind of a repository, if you will, of national assets. We see this true in ancient Israel. We see it in most ancient Near Eastern countries in that time and place. And so the question, or really, their reasoning behind it was, why should such assets be stashed away in a dark storeroom when they could be part of a splendid decor, right? So national buildings, monuments were often built primarily in the form of temples to their gods, but sometimes also, like the kingly palace, etc., which we're going to talk about today, the Solomon's palace. But the architecture was a means by which, we mentioned this last time, but it was a means by which kings of the ancient world, as well as modern time, they aggrandize themselves, right? They want to leave their mark on history. And so one of the ways they do that, right, there's various ways, right? War and conquest is historically a way that kings try to make their mark on history. But another way is through architecture. It's just building fabulous monuments and trying to leave their mark on history in that respect. And if you recall, Solomon, during this era of the ancient Near East, which is pretty well documented, we actually have a lot of history that we can reconstruct from this time and place. But in this era, these several decades, four decades of Solomon's reign, The ancient Near East is almost in a dark ages, if you will, when it comes to architecture. The shining example, the shining, caveat to that would be Solomon. Solomon is the builder in the ancient world during his reign. That's what I want you to see. And archaeology, the archaeological record, has demonstrated that very clearly, very well. We still have remains, mostly foundations, but we can identify several of the building projects that Solomon himself built. There's nothing left of Solomon's temple. That has been completely eradicated. And then the Temple Mount today, if you were to go and see it, it of course has the Muslim holy shrines and mosque on top. But the foundation is actually, that was in Jesus' day. It was built by Herod the Great. But that still post-dates Solomon. So there's really nothing to see in modern-day Jerusalem about Solomon's temple because it's underneath huge courtyard that was built by Herod the Great that is still standing today. So there's not a lot of archaeology on Solomon's temple, but we have other, and we'll talk about it probably more a little bit later, because it's recorded later in the narrative in chapter 9. But when Solomon goes and he fortifies the nation, it describes where he built fortifications, and we can go to those same places today and identify the Solomonic gates that are there. And so I'll show you pictures of that later. But the point is, Solomon is the big builder at this time. He is the primary architect, and in the ancient Near East in this time, and the significance of that is it's a display of God's blessing upon the nation of Israel. And they're in, again, this is the Israeli golden age, as we've said several times. But one of the most, or probably the most obvious example of that would be Solomon's temple. And so we see this was pretty common in the ancient Near East. It was a world, as I say in your notes, in which kings built or refurbished lavish temples as appropriate tributes to their gods or goddesses. In such a world, then the question should be asked, why should Yahweh look like a discount store deity with a government loan house? Okay. In other words, Yahweh is given a lavish temple, and one that would have put all other temples, at least known temples at the time, it would have put them to shame with the splendor, the grandeur of this, and the expense, lavish expense. But it also is, again, it's a display of not only the goodness and the glory and the splendor of Yahweh, but also his blessing upon the nation. And again, we've made this point, but the Israeli golden age is primarily David and Solomon. And Solomon is enjoying the wealth and the splendor that was largely won or accomplished by David. It was largely David's reign that, recall, solidified the borders, conquered the enemies, put to tribute foreign lands, and now Solomon he's reaping what his father sowed, essentially, in the splendor and the glory of the Israeli kingdom at this time. But as we looked last time at the temple itself, my goal this morning is to zoom out and to look at some of his other building projects. And so if you got a Bible, 1 Kings 7, we're going to read chapter 7, verses 1 through 12. And then I'm just going to walk you through this visual, which is, again, it's just an artist rendition, recreation, best we can tell, of what Solomon's building projects in Jerusalem would have looked like. And again, this was my favorite visual just because of the courtyard and the different buildings, et cetera, except for that really long protrusion of the temple. I don't think that was there. But that was, this particular artist is convinced of this. But let's read the text, and then we'll walk through this visual briefly and just try and get a feel for Solomon's other building projects that he accomplished. Obviously, the temple is front and center, and the narrative once it spends three, if you want to tack chapter 5, because he's preparing to build the temple in chapter 5, and then it gives two whole chapters to the construction of the temple, the beauty of the temple. But then we'll have, and this is probably more so, we may introduce it today, but probably get into it more next week. Chapter 8 is then the dedication, the prayer of dedication for the temple. So you actually have four chapters essentially dedicated to the temple. And that is clearly where the author is emphasizing, the narrative, the record. He wants us to understand the significance of this, and he doesn't want it to be lost on us. However, buried in between that is a shorter paragraph of just a few verses where it describes some of his other building accomplishments. So if you got a Bible, 1 Kings 7, verse 1, it says, "But Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all his house." In fact, we'll see, just back up to the end of chapter 6, verse 38, the final phrase, the final line of chapter 6 says, "So was he 7 years in building it." That's the temple. All right, so what I want you to see is the look at 7, and this is probably not consecutive, in other words, simultaneous, they're consecutive. So 7 years he spent building the temple, 13 in building these other things that we're going to read. But you add those together, that's the first half of his reign, right? So he's going to reign for 40 years. The first 20 years, he's going to be occupied primarily in architecture, right? He's building all over the place. And we'll see it, again, chapter 9 will tell us other fortifications like at Megiddo and Gezer, other places around the nation that he's also fortifying. But most of his building projects are going to be centered here in Jerusalem, the capital city. And he's expanding, he's beautifying, he's building the temple, building his own palace, etc. But it's going to take him the first 20 years of his reign. And so that's, I just want you to see the significance of that, right? We often subdivide his reign into the two big chunks of, you know, he's faithful to God for the first half, first 20 years, and then his unfaithfulness, it begins right around the halfway mark. And then he goes off the deep end for a while. And so, and we'll get to that in 1 Kings 11. But notice that first half of his reign, the first 20 years of his reign, wherein he gets good marks. He's considered a king like unto his father David, the text says, back in chapter 3. And so he's considered a godly king, but it's during the time where he's going through these extensive building projects. So let's keep reading. So Solomon, building his own house, 13 years, and he finished all his house. He built also the house of the forest of Lebanon. So notice his palace is different than the house of the forest of Lebanon. The visual, we'll walk through that in a second, but those are two different things. Then it tells us about the house of the forest of Lebanon, verse 2. The length thereof was 100 cubits, the breadth thereof 50 cubits, the height thereof 30 cubits, upon four rows of cedar pillars with cedar beams upon the pillars. And it was covered with cedar above upon the beams that lay on the 45 pillars, 15 in a row. And there were windows in three rows, and the light was against light in three ranks. And all the doors and the posts were square, and the windows and the light was against the light in three ranks. So again, not a lot of detail. It just kind of gives us the basics of what the architecture looks like, which again, that's a big point that a lot of commentators make as you read, whether it's these descriptions of these government buildings that he's making, or it's the temple. Either way, the author is clearly not an architect, okay? In other words, they're not recording data that is sufficient for us to reconstruct an architectural drawing, right? I mean, like, he leaves out whole things, like, we don't even know what kind of roof they had, right? We don't know the facade looked like. You know, there's whole pieces of information that he just doesn't even talk about. But really, the point of it, he's not writing it as an architect, but the author is probably a prophet, and he's writing it from the perspective of really national pride and theological significance, right? That's really the point, is look at the blessing of God. That's really what he's saying. As you read these descriptions, and again, the magic word gold, right, is inserted over and over and over again, and cedar, right? We talked about that. The cedars of Lebanon are famous. We're inside and outside the Bible. But the point is the glory, the splendor, the beauty, the majesty, it's written from the perspective of first, kind of like a proud citizen, right? There's a lot of sense of national pride as he's describing these monuments that, again, in this time and place, Solomon's the big builder. There's no other king or nation that's building it to this scale that other than Solomon in this time. So there's a lot of national pride, but then, of course, theological significance as they're seeing that God is, you know, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is affording the blessing that is allowing them to do this. And so those are the big points. But again, based upon the best we can tell, that's why, you know, this artist rendition is just trying to give you a visual of what it may have looked like. But continuing verse 6, he says, "And he made the porch of pillars, the length thereof," so this is another monument or another building, "the length of it was 50 cubits, the breadth thereof 30 cubits. The porch was before them, the other pillars and the thick beam were before them. Then he made a porch for the throne where he might judge, even the porch of judgment," or the hall of justice, some translations will put it in. In other words, that's where his throne sat, as well as where Solomon heard cases, right? Cases would be brought before him, and he would serve as the ultimate high court of the land, the Supreme Court, if you will. And we saw that back in chapter 3. Remember when he receives the supernatural wisdom from God, and then he has to decide between the two harlots, which one of them owned the baby. And so we see that he is the high judge of the land, Solomon is. So he builds a court of justice for that. And the throne, I was tempted to go and pop over. Well, maybe we will. I am tempted. I'm so tempted. But I can't help myself. Go to chapter 10 real quick. It's later in the narrative, and so we're gonna talk about it again later, underneath, just because chapters 9 and 10, after it records really the first 20 years of Solomon's reign, in chapters 3 through basically 8, like his building accomplishments, then it zooms out and it just talks about the splendor and the majesty of his kingdom. And it spends almost two whole chapters on that. Chapters 9 and 10 are just elaborate descriptions of the beauty of his kingdom, the splendor, the wealth, all of that. And so we'll come back to that theme. But right in the middle of the description of the glory of his kingdom, it talks about the glory of his throne. And there's it's kind of fun. But pick it up in chapter 10, verse 18. It says, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. That thing is ridiculously expensive. Okay, so ivory, we have, and kings go back and forth, but it seems that the throne itself is made of ivory, right? It's not just inlaid with ivory. So for instance, have we talked about this? We talked actually at the marriage conference last year. We talked about this a little bit. Do you remember the Bible calls during the reign of Ahab, all right, so that's later, we're getting to him later, but during the reign of Ahab, he builds a famous palace known as the Ivory House. It's been discovered, it's in the city of Samaria, which was his capital city, and we'll talk about that when we get there, but the Bible calls it the Ivory House, and so it has been discovered by archaeologists, and there they found a bunch of ivory, right, And ivory, of course, was not native to Israel. It had to be imported, mainly from Africa and India. But the ivory was very expensive, highly sought after in the ancient world. We have records of that inside, outside the Bible. Ivory was highly coveted, very valuable. But even the ivory house of Ahab was primarily ivory inlays. Okay, so it had furniture that was made out of wood, and then inlaid into the furniture was figurines made out of ivory, okay? That's what archaeology has discovered in the ivory house. So, but the point is, that is considered lavish in Ahab's day. Well, contrast that with Solomon, who it's possible that his entire throne is made out of ivory, right? I mean, there's, and some debate that, some think it's inlays, but it's still lavish, okay? But then atop the ivory, he covers it with gold, right? So let's keep reading. It says, so the throne is of ivory. He overlays it with the best of gold. The throne has six steps. The top of the throne was round behind it. And there were stays on either side of the place of the seat. And two lions stood beside the stays, the armrests. 12 lions stood there on one side and on the other, one side and the other on the six steps. So a total of, there's six steps going up, lions on each side, total of 12. He says, and there was not, look at this, verse 20. Again, it's written from the perspective of an observer, an eyewitness, but notice the sense of national pride that he feels in this. He says at the end of verse 20, there was not the like made in any kingdom. He says, you can go wherever you want, and you're not going to find a throne room with this kind of splendor. And of course, the beginning of this chapter, we'll get to it later, but in 1 Kings 10, the beginning of the chapter, remember who shows up? Famous account, Queen of Sheba, right? And she travels to come and see Solomon and his the glory of his kingdom, and it describes her visit, and it says, and I love the way, and some English translations bring this out, particularly in Hebrew, it says it took her breath away. It says she was breathless after visiting Solomon's kingdom and seeing his court and seeing his throne room and seeing the glory of it, the splendor, the majesty, the wealth on display. She was in awe, and she was herself a royal, and she was not poor either, because, you know, we'll get there. You can read it on your own. But when we get there, we'll see the size of the gift that she brings to Solomon. I mean, she was no slouch herself. And yet she was in awe of the glory of Solomon. And so that's what I want you to see. So back to chapter 7. That was a sidelight. Okay, I just had to go read the description of the throne real quick. But he's building not just a glorious throne, but of course a hall for the throne, which is where he is sometimes called the court of justice or the hall of justice, depending on your Bible translation. But that's where he does judgment. That's verse 7. So 1 Kings 7, 7. It says, and it was covered with cedar from one side of the floor to the other, and his house where he dwelt and another court within the porch was also a house for Pharaoh's daughter. So now we have next to his house, that is his palace that was mentioned back up in verse 1, is now the house for Pharaoh's daughter. It says, whom he had taken to wife, like unto this porch. So again, you can see that on the visual, and at least, you know, let's zoom in real quick. But in this visual, notice it puts the house of Pharaoh's daughter and Solomon's palace side by side. They're different structures, but they're close, you know, they're nearby. It's a palace complex, if you want to put it that way. And so this, recall this, just a quick comment on this, just by way of reminder, the fact that Pharaoh's daughter gets her own palace is significant. It means that either she was the head queen, or as one commentator put it, she had a daddy that you could not disappoint. Okay. In other words, she was Pharaoh's daughter. And remember, do you remember our discussion of this back in chapter 3? We have copious evidence of this outside of the Bible, especially in the Amarna letters. Now, again, get a glass of water before you read the Amarna letters, okay? Because they're so dry and dusty, it's going to make you cough. You know what I'm saying? It's a little brutal. But I would encourage you, and look it up. They're translated. They're available online. I mean, there's whole books that, you know, Pritchard, I think, has got a book on ancient Near Eastern texts that I've got. You can read the Amarna letters, okay? They've been translated, but they were Egyptian documents discovered in Amarna, Egypt, and they're actually older. They predate Solomon. They're actually just after. They date to just right around the Exodus and just after the Exodus, and most of them come from the reign of the Pharaoh right after the Exodus, but he's contemporary with the Wilderness Wanderings and the Book of Joshua, and so, anyways, there's so much stuff we can get lost in Amarna letters. I freak out about the Amarna letters. There's cool stuff to talk about. But in fact, there's parallels between the Amarna letters and the Book of Joshua, and we could get lost in this. But I'm not teaching Joshua right now. I'm teaching 1 Kings. So stay focused. Okay. But it is really cool. In the Amarna letters, it describes, because it's basically a collection of correspondence between the Pharaoh of Egypt and all of his underlings, and not just his underlings, but other, the other great nations. Remember we talked about this? It's called the Era of the Great Kings, where there were really six big dog empires that were considered kind of equals at the time, like Babylon and the Hittites and the Egyptians. But out of those equal kingdoms, Egypt was recognized as the big dog. They had the largest army. They had the most wealth. They had the most splendor. And one of the ways they demonstrated that, remember this, was that the Pharaoh would never allow his daughters to be married to foreign kings. Now, he would take princesses from foreign nations into his harem, but he would never allow his daughters to be married off. It was a status thing. And we actually have documents. And I almost read one for you a couple weeks ago, but again, I think you just need a cup of water because it's dry and dusty. But there's a letter we have from a Hittite king complaining to the Egyptian pharaoh. He says, man, I gave you one of my daughters. Why can't I have one of yours? Right? And he's like, he's upset at this. But the whole point that I want you to see is that that was a way for them in the ancient world, for the Egyptians to demonstrate their splendor and their superiority over other nations. So when we get to Solomon, if you are at all, again, aware of the ancient Near East and the way it operated, then this is a jaw-dropping thing when you read that Solomon married a daughter of Pharaoh, right? That's the whole point, he has a status that the Pharaoh of Egypt is considering Solomon his superior. That's what I want you to see. Okay, so this is a big deal. Solomon is the big dog during his reign for these 40 years. And really, you know, given a little bit before that with David, but the Israeli golden age, that's why we call it the golden age, is they were the most important nation on the face of the earth at the time. And so that's what we need to recognize, and we need to try and grasp that. But saying all that to say, as much as Solomon is splendid, you know, he has all the splendor and power, and he married a foreigner, you know, the daughter of Pharaoh. Well, he still has to treat her right. Okay, so he builds her own palace, probably to stay on good terms with Egypt. Okay, and you remember this? Why? Because one of the main foundations of his economy, remember, he was an arms dealer. Solomon was. He traded in horses and chariots between the Egyptians to the south and the Hittites to the north. So he had to make sure he stayed on good terms with the Egyptians. Okay, that's what I want you to see. So there's obvious politics going on here, clear politics. But one of the things that makes the list of what Solomon built was the house for Pharaoh's daughter. So keep reading. Where did I leave off? Verse 9, was it? Verse 8, Solomon made a house for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken to wife, like unto his port. So he makes, again, her a palace that is similar to his. All these were of costly stones, verse 9, according to the measure of huge stones, sawed with saws within and without, even from the foundation under the copping, which is on the outside toward the great court. Tidbit on this, I don't think I shared this with you before. If you go to modern Israel and you look at ancient architecture, they just fawn over, you know, ancient architecture. But, and I know more than you want to know, okay, about ancient architecture. But one of the cool things about Israeli limestone, it's native to Israel. But what's interesting is when you quarry it and it's freshly quarried, it's actually pretty soft. So that you can, as it says here, you can saw it with a saw, okay? So like with a hand tool, you can actually shape the stone if it's freshly cut. But once it is, you know, it's exposed to the elements, then it hardens and you can no longer shape it, you know, after a certain amount of time. And so it's interesting, but you remember this is one of the big things that the text made a big point of when Solomon was building the temple, remember? Is they did not have the sound of a hammer on site. They weren't doing any of the hewing on site. Rather, they were shaping the stone off site and then bringing it and fitting them together piece by piece. It was like a giant jigsaw puzzle. But that was not only true of Solomon's temple, it was also true of his palace and all these different buildings that are here being described. Okay, but just a cool little tidbit is you can actually shape Israeli limestone with a saw or a hand tool until it hardens, and then it becomes rock hard, as we say. But moving on, verse 10. And the foundation was of costly stones, even great stones, stones of 10 cubits, stones of 8 cubits, and above were costly stones after the measure of hewn stones and cedars. Again, so we could get lost in this, but the hewn stone and the cedar both, again, displaying the splendor, the value, the wealth, etc. Verse 12, and the great court round about was with three rows of hewn stones and the row of cedar beams, both for the inner court of the house of the Lord and for the porch of the house. Now, that was the section, verses 1 through 12, of what we skipped over last time because we were focusing primarily on the temple. So we skipped verses 1 to 12. We picked up verse 13 and kept reading. But just by way of visual, again, this is roughly, it's an artist's rendition of what it looked like. But you have in Solomon's expansion of Jerusalem in his day, he has the Ophel, which did exist in David's day. It's mentioned in David's reign. The Ophel, there's some debate on that of exactly what that is. Now there's actually a belief that it's referring to the fortification around the Gihon Spring. That's a modern day archaeologist take, just because we found massive fortifications around the Gihon Spring that we didn't know existed before. We just found those, you know, archaeologists found those like 10 years ago. So there's some debate on what the Ophel is. In this picture, it's describing, it's kind of that housing section, right? The top end of the city of David. But before you enter into kind of the royal complex, which is what happens next. So at least according to this artist, what you have next is you have the house of Pharaoh's daughter, Solomon's palace, that were apparently adjacent, according to the text, but they were separate buildings. And then you have the house of the forest of Lebanon, which we'll discover later in other biblical references to it, that it was basically the royal armory. Okay, so all the weapons of war and kind of the armory for the city of Jerusalem, well, that was, they were housed in the house of the forest of Lebanon. So that was your royal armory, basically. Then you have the porch of pillars and the porch of the throne, which it seems to be, according, again, this is just an artist's rendition, because they're described separately in the text, but it seems to be one building, just one's kind of a porch that's attached to the hall, if you will. But that's just the artist's rendition of what that may have looked like. But that's the court of justice. That's where Solomon's throne is. That's where he hears cases and issues verdicts. But then, of course, you have this massive courtyard that kind of binds the whole complex together, which is over top Mount Moriah. And that is today, again, we can't see any of Solomon's stuff because if you go to Israel today, what you walk on is, again, the complex built by Herod the Great in the New Testament time. And so Solomon's would be underneath that. And so we really, you know, archaeology, there's very little archaeology done below that. There is some, by the way. But then, of course, first and foremost, you have the temple, which is given, again, the majority of the description in these chapters. Now, a couple comments on the timing here, and then we'll start a brief introduction of chapter 8. So there, commentators are divided on this. Go back to chapter 6, where the final phrase of chapter 6, and then the first phrase of chapter 7. Notice again the timeline. It says at the final phrase of verse 6 that he was 7 years in building the temple. But, chapter 7, verse 1, but Solomon was building his own house 13 years. Now, scholars go back and forth on this. Most will say, and I don't know. I mean, I'm on the fence. You could convince me either way, okay? But most commentators will see this as a negative foreshadowing. In other words, the glory and the splendor of Yahweh's temple, which is the greatest demonstration of architecture in its day, glorious, you know, $17 billion by modern standards. I mean, very lavish, very expensive, but he spends 7 years in building it. Then the rest of it, he spends almost double that, right? 13 years on his own palace and the complex. And so many begin to see this as early signs or foreshadowing of Solomon's coming unfaithfulness, that he's more concerned with his own, you know, basically palace and his own interests over and above God's. And so while that is very possible, and I think it's possible, maybe even likely, that that's the way the text should be read, other commentators just point out the obvious point that, well, don't forget that the reason that the temple didn't take as long is because David did most of the work ahead of time. Remember that? Because he wanted to build the temple and God wouldn't let him build the temple. So he said, okay, but he's going to do everything but build the temple, right? So if you remember the end of the book of First Chronicles, it's several chapters, is devoted to David's gathering the materials, making the plans. In other words, when Solomon inherits the job to build the temple, it's a turnkey operation. Everything is there. Everything is ready to go. It's all paid for. I mean, it's all David's work. And all Solomon has to do is organize the work crews and say, get to work. And so it makes sense why the temple would have not taken as long, because it was already half done, all the preparations were done, before Solomon even starts the project. And so, you know, you got to factor that in, okay? But even with that said, most commentators are still of the persuasion that, because we know the end of the story, right? And so we can read sometimes later parts of the story back into earlier parts of the story. And we start looking for foreshadowings. And we've done that already, where Solomon does clearly go overboard. And he's starting to violate, even early in his reign a little bit, but definitely by the halfway mark of his reign, he starts blatantly violating every command of Deuteronomy 17. Remember? Because there's three things they were not supposed to multiply. What are they? Wives. Yeah, good job on that one, Solomon, right? Yeah, plenty of multiplying wives, okay? We're going to see that in chapter 11. What's the other one? Horses. And how does he make his money? He's a horse trader between, you know, the Hittites and the Egyptians. Okay, so that's a problem. And then gold, right? And we'll see that when we get there, well, I mean, I mentioned that earlier. I mean, the 11 times gold is mentioned in the temple, which, okay, you know, we can give him that because that's the temple for God, for Yahweh. But when we go back to chapter 10, And I'm getting ahead of myself just a little bit. But in chapter 10, we just read the description of his throne. But if you keep reading, it describes in verse 21, it says, and all of King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. All the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver. Silver was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. For the king had a sea of navy of Tarshish, the navy of Hiram, and it's describing that in 3 years they'd come ships loaded with gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks, which is interesting, right? We'll talk about it later, but that's where most think it's coming from. Deep Africa and India is where many of these are coming from, but maybe even further abroad, because it took them 3 years. It was a 3-year round trip for these ships. But then it goes on to describe, you know, he exceeded, verse 23, all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. In fact, if you pop over to verse 26 and 7, same chapter, 1 Kings 10, 26 and 7, says, and Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots. Okay, that's kind of multiplying horses and chariots, right? 12,000 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the king of Jerusalem. And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones. Right? Silver was so common, it was like a common stone. There was so much silver. He says, and cedars he made as the sycamore trees that are in the vale for abundance. Again, cedars were the highly coveted wood, right, from Lebanon. And the juniper, or the sycamore, is like our juniper here, right? It's kind of like a scrub brush tree. It's a wannabe tree, okay? You know what I'm talking about? Especially those of you who lived in Idaho. You know, you come from like big country, right? A big wood country. And you're like, yeah, that's a wannabe tree here in Nevada, okay? Well, that's kind of like it was sycamore versus cedar, okay? The cedar's the big dog. That's the heavily coveted tree. But he says he had so much cedar in Jerusalem, it was like the sycamore tree. Do you have a thought? Yes.
Having been made of ivory, but gold laid over the top of it, which sounds to me like you couldn't see the ivory.
Yeah, it kind of depends. Yeah, that's how I read it. I mean,
and I was thinking about that. I thought, and so symbolically, I was doing a little bit of reading as you're talking, and it was kind of the gold. I guess was more of like a divine glory appearance, but the internal ivory being the sense of purity or incorruptibility,
mm-hmm.
and maybe because that's his throne. You know, he's still a man. And he had the wisdom of his heart, but I wonder if kind of the argument about early maybe losing a little humility or something,
mm-hmm.
is an indicator of him saying my throne is incorruptible, and you know, but he's still a man. We should all know that we need to maintain that humility about ourselves, because
that's right.
So
amen.
I was just thinking about that and the cedars. I know they're kind of long lasting, you know, kind of wood.
That's right.
Anyway.
Yeah, highly coveted. The cedars are fascinating.
Yeah, the ivory being covered with gold, I just thought, wow, why would they do that? And I was doing a little reading.
Well, and notice even the cedars. So I showed this picture, was it last week, a week before, a couple weeks ago. These are, you know, modern day shots of the cedars of Lebanon, which is largely deforested today. There are some left on the mountains of Lebanon. That would be like the modern country of Lebanon, is where the ancient Phoenician Empire was, and where these cedars were coming from. But they were highly valuable, extremely, you know, beautiful, but they, because of its extreme bitterness, they repelled insects and worms. So they did not decay as rapidly as other wood. The cedars of Lebanon are renowned inside and outside the Bible. We've talked about that. We have Babylonian records where the Babylonian kings want to build their palaces out of the cedars from Lebanon because of their durability and their beauty, et cetera. But even the cedars, most of this is covered with gold, right? So, but the point is, it's the best building material of the day, right? There is no expense spared, right? It is lavish in the temple as well as his palace, you know, and the palace for the daughter of Pharaoh, etc. But you're right. It's when you look at this, you and I, we just kind of read over that. But if we pause and just do a little bit of research on what that meant for them in the ancient world, then you soon realize that there was no expense spared. I mean, this was extremely lavish to the point that it is the awe of all other nations, right? And that's where, like we read a moment ago, but in chapter 10, well, you know, where the author writes it down, he says, there was no other kingdom that had a throne like this, Like, we are unique. We are the best, right? There's a sense of national pride and all of that. Now, but again, we should read that sensitively. As Bible readers, we should read it from two angles. First, we should see it, and especially your first read through. Okay? You're familiar with this? Advanced Bible readers, we begin, because if you've never read the Bible, then by all means, read the Bible, please. It's the most important book in human history. Really important. Okay. But there is such a thing as the first and the second read, or first read and later read. In other words, the first time you're reading the Bible, you don't know the end of the story yet. You don't know all the details yet. And so it strikes you a certain way the first time you read it. And one of the arts of Bible study, deep study, is to try to disabuse your mind of what you already know and read the text as if it were the first time you were reading it. That takes extreme mental discipline, but it actually makes you a better student because you're not assuming things about the text that the original audience would not have known yet, right? You're trying to read the text from the perspective of the original audience. And it's a fun way to read the Bible, but it takes a lot of thought and foresight to do that. But for instance, your first read of this text, you're walking away with tremendous, like, wow, this is amazing. And I think in a sense, that's what the whole text is meant to be, right? The eyewitness is recording this with a high degree of national pride and recognizing the blessing of God upon the nation, right? So don't miss that. This is the Israeli golden age. You should read this, especially your first time through. That's how most people, it's going to strike them, is they're like, wow, This is really evidence of God's blessing, and this is amazing, right? God is fulfilling his covenant promises that he made all the way back with Moses on Sinai and through Deuteronomy and et cetera. That's, all of that is absolutely true. However, there's also a second read, and this is when we read the story in light of the end, right? As I mentioned a moment ago, is once you read the Bible all the way through, once you know more details, now you go back and you'd give it a second reading and you read it with a different perspective because now you know where history's headed. You didn't know where history was headed before. It's like you're a firsthand eyewitness, you know, just kind of watching events as they unfold. But now once you've completed it and you go back and you read it again, then you come with more scrutiny. You come with a sharper eye. You come with, you know, you're looking for things. Sometimes we overread the text. I think sometimes, and that's misinterpreting, right? We got to be careful of that. I think sometimes we're reading too much into it. But that's part of the art of Bible study and becoming a good, avid, sharp, you know, intelligent Bible reader is to just read it constantly. But do so in small chunks where you read a verse at a time and you do word studies and you do cross references and you dive deep on that verse. But then you zoom out and you read the whole book in one sitting, right? You read like 20, 30 chapters all in one time. And you're trying to get big picture, you're trying to get small picture, you're trying to zoom in, you're trying to zoom out, you're trying to understand it from all of its various angles. But most scholars recognize, because we know the end of the story, particularly when we get to chapter 11, we know that Solomon goes off the deep end. Depending on how you read Ecclesiastes, it's very likely, in my opinion, that Solomon does come back around. He acknowledges his sinfulness, he acknowledges his failures, and he comes back to God in his old age. That's how I read Ecclesiastes. Not everybody does. But even with that, that colors the way that you study Solomon, right? If you know the end of the story, that he's going to go off the deep end for a while and run away from God, and he's going to break every commandment of Deuteronomy 17. Knowing that, we read those early chapters a little bit different, right? And we start seeing, exactly as Bob said, we start seeing maybe areas where it's like, ooh, maybe Solomon, you went a little too far there. A little overboard. Oh, maybe you're getting that big head. Oh, you know, maybe you actually shouldn't have done that. That was a misstep, right? But we see it differently knowing the end of the story. And so that's, and again, learn to love the Bible. Just read it constantly. Make it your lifelong companion. But you will discover the more advanced you become in your Bible reading, you'll see things later that you didn't see before. And that's okay. That's the way it's designed to be, right? That's fine. But that makes it fun, right? To read and a little bit of a debate. Why, you know, in these moments, where was Solomon? Where was his heart? We don't know, other than when the text tells us. So, like, for instance, and I've got just a couple minutes left, but go back to 1 Kings 3 with me real quick. And I'm kind of stealing my thunder for later because I was going to go all into this more in chapter 9 and 10. So you know what's coming, okay? But go back to 1 Kings 3 and notice verse 3. It says, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places. Now it goes on to describe how he then builds the tabernacle, or the temple rather, which is the permanent version of the tabernacle, and that becomes the center of sacrifice in accordance with the commands of God in Deuteronomy 12, you know, etc. But notice, early on in his reign, he's actually given good marks. He loves God, and he is obedient like his father David. Okay, like, that's pretty good marks. And we'll see when we get to chapter 9, I'm going to head on myself again, but this is helpful, right? Because now as you read and reread Solomon's reign, you can gain deeper perspective. But go now to chapter 9, 1 Kings 9. I'm jumping ahead. But after Solomon builds the temple, he then prays a prayer of dedication. That's what we're going to get into next week, is 1 Kings 8. Some consider it the most important chapter in the book of 1 Kings, this 1 Kings 8. So we're going to give that due attention, okay? But after he prays the prayer of dedication, chapter 8, then God comes to him a second time in a dream. And God actually gives him a warning, right? He gives him, again, he's blessing him, and he's acknowledging that, yes, I like the house that you just built. Great job there, right? So he's praising Solomon, but he's also giving Solomon a pretty stern warning. And I think it's interesting that, again, as we read this, we're like, you know, but this is the halfway mark of his reign. Because chapter 9, verse 1 says, and it came to pass when Solomon had finished the building of the house of the Lord, remember that took 7 years, and the king's house, that took 13, so that's 20 years, right? So that the first 20 years of his reign is now over. Then the Lord appears to him a second time as he appeared to him at Gibeon. So God shows up early in Solomon's reign. That's the first appearance. That's chapter 3. Well, now he shows up again at the midway point. And I think it's interesting, but so far as we can tell, Solomon hasn't gone off the deep end yet. However, there's a pretty strong warning here. There seems to be signs already, right? That God is saying, great job, Solomon, stay faithful, but don't walk away from me. If you walk away, it's going to get rough. And God gives him a stern warning in chapter 9. Well, then we have a zoom out, and it describes all the glory and the splendor of Solomon's kingdom at the end of chapter 9 and all of chapter 10. But now I'll go to chapter 11, verse 1. But King Solomon loved many strange women, many foreigners, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, the women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and the Hittites, of nations concerning which the Lord said to the children of Israel, you shall not go into them. So in other words, he was violating an express command of God. He says, why? For surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. So it's a clear text, right? It's a clear statement in the text that Solomon's heart was turned away from God. Now, again, based upon the best estimates of dating, that's roughly the halfway mark of his reign, right? Probably, you know, maybe a little bit after, but it's after the appearance of God to him in chapter 9. But in that last 20 years, somewhere in there is when he starts going off the deep end. And so, again, as we read that, we know the end of the story, we know where it's going, but we've got to try to learn to read the Bible from both perspectives. Does that make sense? Which, you guys are sophisticated Bible students, right? You can hold two ideas in your mind at once. And that's the whole idea, is learning to see, okay, there's the good in Solomon and the bad. And but isn't that true to life? It's so crystal clear to us, you know, the longer we live and we start realizing, wow, that's just life. We can't necessarily just whitewash someone and everything they did was good. Nor can we blackmark them and say everything that they did was bad. Rather, Bible characters are human beings. They're complex characters. They're real people. living with real desires and real struggles. And so there are times that they're greatly loyal to God and greatly blessed by God as a result. But then there's times where, and we'll talk about it more when we get there, but their heart turns away from God. And to me, that's the biggest lesson. I just recently got another call from my mentor, Chuck Crabtree. Love talking to that guy. But this is one of the things he beats this drum over and over, and he has since I've known him my whole life. He's been saying, it's not just how you start, it's how you finish. And, you know, he was just telling me in my last conversation with him, he says, Jeff, you had a better start than I did. He goes and he talks about, like, he often talks about his start, you know, and he was an unbeliever until, I think it was like 2021 before he became a believer. And he talks about just the years wasted, right? And I look at him and I'm like, dude, but now he's 90, right? And he's had 70 years of incredible faithfulness to God. Like, I mean, the most godly man I know. And yet he regrets his first 20. And he's like, Jeff. And now I don't know how long I'm going to live, but, you know, I mean, I've got probably a little bit more time ahead of me than behind me. Depends on, you know, the average age. But I look back and he says, Jeff, you had a better start than I did. Don't waste it. That's what he's saying. Because it's not just how you start, it's how you finish. And he brings that up to me almost every conversation that I have with him. And it's such a powerful reminder. And it's also helpful because for many of those sitting in the room, you look back and you're like, man, well, I didn't actually have a great start. I wasted years of my life, decades maybe. But it's not just how you start, it's how you finish. How are you using the time that you have left? And it's amazing how God can use it for his glory if we just dedicate it to him. It's amazing how he can, remember the book of Joel? How he can restore unto us the years the locusts have eaten. He can restore in one season years of loss. He can bring it back. And that's the God that we serve. It's a remarkable thing. But every time I read, and it's not just Solomon, but we'll see this big theme over and over in nearly every king that is mentioned. You'll see their potential and then their flaws. And it's such a lesson for us. Are we taking life seriously? What are we doing with the time now and the time that we have left? Because that makes all the difference. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for the time here this morning as we continue to study the life and reign of King Solomon. And Lord, we see, because we're Bible readers that have the whole Bible, Lord, we know the end of the story. We see what's coming. We ask that you would help us to not let that overcolor our thinking, and we would indeed recognize the blessing of God upon the early days of Solomon and the incredible love and faithfulness he had to God and all the incredible blessing that you bestowed upon him. But yet, Lord, also knowing that his heart does turn away, we begin to see perhaps early signs of it. And we weep over that. Lord, our hearts are burdened over that. And yet, as we look carefully at his life, may we look carefully at our lives. May we let the Bible, not more important than reading the Bible, we need to let the Bible read us. We need to see our life from the perspective of the Bible, and we need to see our story through the lens of the Bible. And we ask that you would help us to see it clearly, and we would acknowledge areas that maybe we've done well and had a good start or whatever. But Lord, might we also acknowledge the truth that it's not just how we start, it's how we finish. And are we staying faithful? Or for those who come to Christ at a later age, what are they doing with the time that they have left? And Lord, I pray that you would help us to gain this perspective. That's one of the most valuable things from studying history, is we can see lives of decades, but we can see it summarized and condensed in just a few chapters. And we can gain such a powerful perspective on life. And we ask that, Lord, you would help us to do that. Help us to learn and to not lose the lessons that you've placed here for us. So we do pray as we close this hour, prepare for the next. And Lord, we look forward to even next week as we come back together, continue to study the life of Solomon. Lord, help us to learn and to live what we learn for your glory. And we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.